So the fundamental root, we're talking about the concept or the idea, the notion of enlightenment, and we're talking about the fundamental basis of the path of the Buddha, the path of the awakened state of mind. And we're discussing the three marks of existence, which are the fundamental core teaching of Buddhism. These are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca being the notion of impermanence. Dukkha, the observation of the dissatisfactoriness of life, the fundamental underlying pain or dissatisfaction that is always a part of life. And finally, anatta, the principle of no self, no separate individuality, no core of being, no soul, no kernel of individuality. Right. So when we talk about enlightenment, or when enlightenment is discussed, what it means is that the it means the recognition of our true nature, the experience of the truth of anatta. Anatta, out of the three marks of existence, other traditions have said everything is impermanent. Other traditions have said life is suffering, or life is dissatisfactoriness. There is a distinction between dissatisfactoriness and suffering. I go into that later. There's a difference between pain and suffering. Pain is simply pure sensation. Suffering is a response to pain. Suffering is what we add on to fundamental pain. I can feel pain, or I can suffer with pain. Suffering is sort of an active hobby kind of thing that we do with the pain. It's no longer fundamental pain. It's my pain. And it's not just a pain in my knee. It's, oh, my knee hurts. So that's something we add on to it. But the unique truth of the three marks of existence is anatta, no self. And this mark of existence is not part of any other tradition. This is the mark that distinguishes Buddhism from all other traditions. And this is why the Buddha is called the Anatta Veda, the teacher of impersonality. It's not, you know, even in within the Hindu tradition and the Vedic traditions and the other traditions, that Buddhism essentially has as its basis. I mean, it didn't come out of nothing. Buddhism just didn't pop up. I mean, you know, the Buddha himself was, you know, a product of of his environment, product of the Vedic tradition, a product of the prevailing Hindu philosophies of the time. They weren't exactly Hindu at that point. They were sort of pre-Hindu. But I mean, these were not, these were sophisticated traditions even 2,500 years ago. They had an incredible history to them. But he was very much a product of that environment. He was well-educated. I mean, he was a prince. So, this guy did not, come out of nothing. So he had a framework to work with, and that framework became incorporated into the basis of the Buddhist tradition. What did not come was the anatta principle, and that is what came through the awakening, through the Buddha's what we call Sartori. There are two terms that are used in the Zen tradition, Sartori and Kensho. They are not interchangeable. Sartori refers to the Buddha's Kensho. Well, you and I don't have Sartori. We have Kensho. The Buddha had Sartori. So, what it boils down to is that enlightenment is, and these are only words, this is like the analogy that I've made before about teaching a class on sex to virgins. I can sit up here and expound forever on the nuances and the feelings and everything that's involved in having sex, but I can't convey the actual experience. No matter how much I talk. It's like doing a class on skydiving. No matter how profound and eloquent the explanation is, it ain't nothing like, hitting the door at 2,000 feet and piling out. You can't convey that sensation in words. So this is what what we're dealing with here is that precise kind of situation. Non-intellectual, we can talk about it till we're blue in the face, but the actual experience is always elusive. Now, anatta, the experience of recognizing our true nature. Now, the Buddha says, I say, the teachers say, the Buddhist texts say that there is no soul, no self, no separate individuality, either inside or outside. Right, that this is all illusion, all of it, even the sense of somebody being actually at home. Right. And the recognition of that truth, the full experience of that, is the seeing one's face, seeing one's true nature. Awakening. If anything could be an approximate description of awakening, that is it. Of truly experiencing the truth of anatta. Okay, and this is the basis for the Buddhist tradition. This is what happened to him. Okay, and it's happened to others. This is not some isolated incident that happened to some god or demigod 2,500 years ago. This happened to a man, to a human being, and has happened to other human beings along the way, and in no different, not a second class enlightenment, not a mini enlightenment, just very much the same awakening. You know, it just isn't. It's not like it's something secondary. It is when Kensho happens, it is the actual awakening of the Buddha himself. No different, nothing else. It's not my awakening. It's the awakening of the Buddha. The Buddha, the word itself means awakened one. He who has woken up to the truth. So, given that this is the fundamental ground, there is nobody, no self, no soul, no separate individuality. What is the nature of that which is reborn?
The nature of that which is reborn?
Right.
From what I can understand, it's all that prior karma coming public.
Karma?
All that cause and effect that you've done.
Right.
Somehow in the writings they say you're responsible for it.
You?
Me. Ah. It. Something. I don't know.
That's a good point.
You know, it's almost like splitting a hair. It comes forward. You caused it. You have to answer for it, but there is no you.
Theoretically.
Is it that sense of self which causes the continuation, having that sense of self, that sort of creates that momentum of a rebirth or whatever?
There is a lot of misunderstanding, particularly in the West and particularly in the American Dharma scene regarding the terminology. Okay, reincarnation and rebirth are not synonymous. All right, so we have the notion of reincarnation, which came out of the Hindu tradition, which has as its basis the idea of Atman, or sort of the greater self. You know, this notion of a universal cosmic consciousness, soul, you know, sort of like one big kind of giant soul that all of us are just itty bitty parts of, this kind of notion. And the reincarnate means I think from a Western perspective that there is, and again, this has been influenced heavily by our Christian background in particular, in that we are working within a social framework, as was the Buddha at his time. He had only his social framework to work from. I mean, we're all in that situation. So we have sort of a Christian social framework. No matter whether we're Christian or not, the society, our social structure has those elements within it. And one of those elements is this the idea of self and soul, the idea of separate individuality. It's very much a part of our social structure, whether we're religious or not, even if we're atheistic. That notion is there. It's part of our legal system. It's part of our psychology. It's part of our social structure, part of our community structure. It's totally interwoven. So the idea of reincarnation, when it came out, and this was also part of the Christian tradition for quite some time, back in the early days of the Christian Gnostics also had notion of reincarnation. It was suppressed within the church because they decided that they were going to set out, you know, a specific dogma that did not include reincarnation. That was a little too much for them. So they created the dogmatic structure of the idea of one lifetime, this is it, and it's either, heaven or hell, after that. But the idea that there was, something there that was going to continue on after death was very much a part of it. So the concept of reincarnation involved the transmigration of a soul or some kernel of essence or quintessence of the individual would be somehow transmigrate from one lifetime to the next. I mean, we have all these ideas that, depending on my karma, my action in this lifetime will determine whether I am born in the next lifetime as a rich man driving a Lincoln Continental or as some poor slob working in Bradley's or, even worse, a farm animal in a barnyard or, whatever. But we have the notion that there's some kind of seed of me that's going to continue. And then it's very, very, very strong. We don't want to die. And where does that come from? And then the notion of rebirth, which is still misunderstood. The notion of rebirth, the idea of rebirth in the Buddhist tradition, when you really, really come down to it and start questioning that teaching of rebirth, it's on two levels. And this becomes painfully obvious when you start looking at the Tibetan tradition. Because you have a level of understanding of the tradition that essentially is the common level, and then you have the sort of privileged level of understanding. So, the lamas, the highly educated, highly trained lamas, are sitting sort of at the top of the pile on this thing. They have a very precise understanding of the meaning of all of these things. but they're also dealing with a peasant population and their social structure that they've had for thousands of years. They're as much stuck with that as we are with ours. And of course, they have used their position in that society to maintain that social structure, and they're dependent on the peasants below them. So what they do is they wind up giving them tchotchkes. They give them beads, amulets, trinkets, chants, beliefs, all of this stuff. So the average Tibetan or the average peasant, even in non-Tibetan country, I mean, you go to any of the countries, the Buddhist countries in the world, and you will find that the common people very much have the idea of reincarnation. And they very much have the idea of self-existence. This is a fundamental notion that we have. I mean, this is our condition. Whether we're born in a Christian country or a Buddhist country, it doesn't mean that is not there. So, you know, the peasantry or the common people have one level of understanding, and to their minds, rebirth involves, you know, they really think that, you know, Lama Joe over here dropped dead, and then, you know, they found, you know, Lama Harry over here, who is the reincarnation of Joe, and that something from Joe somehow got over into Harry, and now Harry's the little kid who... But when you really question the Lamas and really, really penetrate, and you do have to really pursue the matter, what they ultimately come down to is they say, well, there is, you know, it's not a self that has transmigrated. It is something called karmic propensity, the result of the karma of the prior incarnation. But even the term incarnation isn't quite right. Question?
Sounds like mental masturbation.
Good point. But I mean, you know, what are we really doing? What's really taking place here? This Dharma, incomparably profound and minutely subtle, is hardly met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of eons. We now can see this, listen to this, accept and hold this. May we completely understand and actualize this Tathagata's true meaning. The chances of awakening to our true nature are slimmer than slim. Can't be taught. Even sitting up here talking about this, is dancing with words, dancing on books. It's a class of, on skydiving in the dojo. Doesn't quite convey the real thing. Doesn't at all convey the experience. We talk about it. And our efforts in sitting practice, if you read the Three Pillars, have you read the Three Pillars of Zen? Have you read it? Yeah. Well, everybody knows then where that book goes and what that book is about. That was, I think, the first book on Zen that I ever read back in 66, 67, somewhere around there. And I mean, I got the idea that from reading that there was, that if I pushed hard enough, right, that if I exerted my, you know, I mean, that's what you get from it. You know, it's this notion of, God damn it, if I push hard enough and hard enough and hard enough, I'll make some kind of breakthrough and I'll be enlightened. I'll have Kensho. Explain.
Because the Buddha says the more you cling, scratching, and all that kind of stuff, you're doing the exact opposite. That's why it's pushing didn't make sense. What did you touch
on? Well, that is indeed the case. You know, Trungpa Rinpoche used to speak of dealing with, in his case in particular, the terminology he would use would be dealing with spiritual friend. And dealing with ego. His teaching very much involved an examination of the structure of ego, the functioning of the ego structure in mind. I mean, it has form. You know, there are ego. The ego has a mental structure that has elements to it and mechanisms within it that are universal. I mean, you know, with you know, many, many variations, but I mean, these are describable, you know, illustratable elements. And he would say that working with ego and his take on it was that in dealing with this ego, it's like wearing it out like an old shoe. Right? We you know, we don't just throw the shoe away, we sort of wear it until it wears through. Until we have a hole in it. And then we discard it. So given the situation that we're stuck with where we are, what we have to work with, we can't abandon what we have. I mean, we can't just say, well, you know, the book says I don't have an ego, and the book says that I'm not really here, so let's just forget about that and, you know, presto changeo, here I am. We're still stuck with the fact that we're stuck. And the thing with the idea of the Kensho is that we do have a tendency to want to do that. We want to make some kind of breakthrough. We really want to do that. I mean, otherwise, why the hell would we be doing this? Yeah, you know, I mean, what are we sitting here for? Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, there's a number of ways that people approach this, and I think in Kaplow's book he talks about five approaches to Zen. And I don't particularly recall the individual ones, but I mean there are very definite approaches to Zen. I mean, I got a letter from a prisoner the other day who was very concerned about his parents. This guy's on death row, and he wanted me to somehow contact his parents and introduce them to Zen with the idea that it would make them healthy if they practiced it. His concern was not with awakening particularly. He just wanted his parents to, you know, have a more healthy and less stressful life. Well, you know, that's one approach. And then, you know, there's the idea of approaching Zen from the perspective of psychological health, the idea of approaching it from a position of wanting to gain power, the idea of approaching it from the perspective of the desire for enlightenment, the desire for complete awakening. And what it comes down to, really, is that we're stuck with what we have to work with. We can't pretend that we're not. Well, that's why we do this on Sunday mornings when some of us show up. So this whole thing, this whole idea of Kensho, and believe me, the book did a great service, I think, as far as I was concerned, the Three Pillars of Zen, because I had not had any kind of notion of this prior to reading this. I mean, this was 66, 67. I mean, I was like 16, 17 years old, and I read this thing, and I was like, wow, this is really far out. And I mean, I there were enough, you know, testimonials in there, and you know, I mean, people going around saying, "Wow, you know, you've had Kensho, you know, so wonderful, you know, everything's different, and you know, the whole universe dropped away, and you know, da 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 da." And I mean, you read this stuff, and you think to yourself, you know, "Wow, I'm going to be this great big god thing sitting up here, you know, totally, you know, I'm, yeah, I mean it." And of course, this is the only way we have of relating to it, because we're stuck with our own egoistic impressions of what things are. So we're looking at some, you know, external concept and relating to it as an ego entity, and you know, we sort of co-opt the thing into our own egoistic you know, patterns of desire. When I become enlightened, I'm going to become so-and-so and such, you know, ooh, it's going to be grand. Well, yeah, maybe. Maybe. But when, you know, and again, you know, the idea of, you know, from the book, you get the idea that this is something you know, you push and push and push and push and, you know, you're somehow gonna make the breakthrough. I mean, it's like a giant cosmic orgasm. Yeah. Right, very much. You know, cosmic masturbation. You know, I'm gonna pump and pump and pump, and then all of a sudden, bleh, you know, and here we are. So that's what we do. We go hang around Zen centers. We do sessions. We push the limit. I mean, those of you who are here, we do this on Sunday, 2.5 hours, big deal. You know, periodically we do an all-day sitting. You know, wow. But this is nothing. This is infantile practice compared to what goes on in a Rinzai monastery, where you're talking about training for years and doing session, taking part in 7-day sessions, doing 4 of those a year or more. I mean, doing six week-long sessions each year. I mean, and the level of intensity and pushing that takes place in these things is really, really phenomenal. I mean, you're pushing yourself to the limit. This is not lightweight practice by any means. They can be brutal. And again, I remember when coming back from Jusan's execution and my contact with him, I remember coming back to the monastery and talking to Edo Roshi about this and telling him about all of the things that Jusan and I went through. His comment was, death row, living on death row and under threat of execution is far more intense practice than the artificial stress that we induce during session. What we induce during session is an artificial stress designed to push you to the limit. Right? So, and I think that is very true. Many people I've known people who have attended many, many, many sessions and done intensive Zen practice over the years. And I know some of them who have really awakened, who have this insight, this kensho. And for many of those people, and I would say really the majority of them, the kensho, that awakening, did not come out of just the intense practice during session. Invariably, it comes through the occurrence of natural stress and difficulty in life, life itself, the losses that we're presented with, the depression, the dissatisfaction, our daily stress, the loss of a loved one, the negative experiences that we may run into in our life are very much a part of waking up. I mean, awakening is a desperate act. Desperate, incredibly desperate, to get to the point of realization of our true nature is desperate beyond belief. Utterly desperate. Utterly desperate. Giving up the notion of self, the notion of this separate individuality is not a lightweight matter at all. It's an ultimately desperate act, because all the time we're constantly attempting to maintain it. It's a constant maintenance affair. so perhaps the approach, the idea of the approach that we get from the three pillars of Zen, of pushing towards Kensho, Kensho, Kensho all the time, perhaps this is not the way to proceed at all. Perhaps this is wearing out the old shoe. Perhaps this is nothing more than, maybe we're confusing the process for the result. The process of wearing out the shoe, of pushing towards Kensho, pushing towards Kensho. You keep doing that until you get the idea, hey, what the fuck am I doing this for? Stop! But we can't, because we know that there's something out there to push towards. So we keep doing it. Well, the teacher will support that. Go for it! Go for it! Push, 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 push! Kensho, Kensho, Kensho! Wake up, wake up! In the meantime, he's sipping tea. Oh, so grasshopper. Go for it. Keep beating your head against the wall until you get the idea that you should stop. Go for it. Beat, beat, beat. Don't take my word for it. Go for it.
Value?
Why make the effort?
Well, it seems that we have a dilemma. We have a dilemma. And we can't think of any other way other than making the effort. We don't have a clue other than to make this effort. Because that's everything we've done in the past. I mean, it's always involved, you know, all our schooling, you know, we study and we learn all these things so we can take the test, right, at the end and get the prize, which is a grade on our report card, whatever, you know, what everything that we've done in life, you know, if you're good, you'll get a cookie, you know, if you do this, then you'll get that. You know, it's all a mechanistic approach to living. It's a materialistic approach to living, to life. You know, I'm reading a book now called Future Primitive. And in the book, the first essay talks about the approach of indigenous peoples to life and how the advent of agriculture, how going from a hunting-gathering way of existence to an agricultural way of existence, the changes that take place in a culture making that transition. Right, the hunter-gatherer having no concepts of boundaries, no ideas of personal property, equality of sexes. I mean, a foraging community, you know, a woman can forage as good as a man can forage as good as a woman. You know, and it's only when the domestication started taking place, when we started saying, well, I'm going to plant vegetables now, instead of simply going out and foraging for vegetables, we're now planting them. So, well, I can't just plant, I plant them within a plot. So herein the idea of territory starts coming into play. And then we start talking about division of labor. And then this all develops into what we have out here, this giant product that we've produced after, you know, 8,000, 10,000 years of so-called civilization. But when we backtrack and we start looking at the stress level is, our stress level is decreasing. I mean, who can say, whose stress level is decreasing? Anybody? That's what I mean. It's getting worse and worse and worse.
Stress level is not decreasing, but what I have found is how you approach that stress response. I can run with that stress and let myself get freaked out, or I can take another approach and may not cause the suffering.
Well, you still got to deal with it.
Got to deal with it. But that's part of life.
That's part of that life.
That
one. It'll bring on a 10 shows.
Over here, let me hit you with one of these blocks.
Wake the fuck up! Whap!
I've often thought, you know, modern-day Kensho, you know, standing there with a 92S Beretta going, wake up!
Been there and done that.
Yeah, right.
But Sensei, back to your Kaplow's five reasons for doing this.
No, see, that's going to kill me because I can't remember them
well,
all.
Whatever they are, but I guess... Why start?
Well, yeah, very good point. Why start? Get the hell out. But, you know, Trungpa used to say it's best not to begin. But once you've begun, it's best to be finished with it. I remember walking by the lake one day talking to Roshi, and he was saying, yeah, ignorance really is bliss. I mean, certainly, if you know, I had remained in ignorance, I wouldn't have had to spend 30 years of hell doing, you know, nasty-ass practice and, you know, dragging my butt all over the country and sitting in zendos and you know, temples and all of this shit. Hell, I could be a, you know, I could be a doctor now making real money. You know, why am I in prisons teaching Zen? Why am I corresponding with, you know, all these prisoners? I could be, you know, an executive somewhere.
What's your perspective on the Bodhisattva
path? Ooh, talk about leading questions.
Is that more mental masturbation, or is that...
Well, it is, yeah. It's very much so. Because the Bodhisattva has no concept of the Bodhisattva path. The Bodhisattva path is that's the lecture on sex. That's the you know, when we sit here, the Bodhisattva path involves, you know, six levels of this and three elements of that, and then, you know, it involves the, you know, the great vows, and it involves this, and the Bodhisattva has to be that, and you know, we've got all these descriptions. But the Bodhisattva has no need for any of that crap. The Bodhisattva is simply doing the Bodhisattva, not talking about, examining. The Bodhisattva is not out there saying, well, gee, I can't do this because I have to, you know, it's got to meet with the precepts, and it's got to, you know, I've got to, you know, let's see, however innumerable all beings are, I'm going to save them all, okay, that, and... Let's see. However, yeah, right. We know. It's not like you've got a checklist of. Let's see. Now I'm going to check my Bodhisattva activity here. Let's see. Is it this? Is it that? Is it that? It'll check them off. No, it's not like that at all. It's far more spontaneous, and far more outrageous and wild. We have the concept, and in fact, I'm writing an article on this. about the Bodhisattva, that the Bodhisattva is somehow Mr. Rogers.
This goes back to where we started. But I wanted to come back to your Trungpa's debauchery, which is kind of where we started, and how to reconcile that.
Well, what are we reconciling?
Well, I guess against the Vinaya and the Eightfold Path, if nothing else.
Okay, you know, I mean, this is all well and good. You know, Trungpa was outrageous. No question about that. He drank like a fish. He screwed like it was going out of style, and he did all kinds of wild stuff. And, you know, my friend John spent 8 years with the man, you know, living with him and taking care of him and you know, I mean, dressing him and the whole nine yards. You know, and he was completely wild. Wild beyond belief. And, I mean, John, some of the stories that John tells about Trungpa Rinpoche are just incredible. And I mean, you know, his students or his followers or, you know, the people that are, you know, now a part of that organization, which has continued, I mean, they don't want to hear those stories. You know, that stuff, you know, they don't really want that stuff out there because it's too wild. You know, and I mean, we all had the idea that we could, you know, by somehow imitating his behavior, we would also be, you know, privileged to his insight. Not the case. Believe me, not the case. And again, that's his style. He chose to... It was his choice to drink all that booze. Personally, I tried that. It's not my trip.
Going back to what you mentioned before, it is not killing yourself with all that contempt that bang that story.
Take it easy. Take it easy. Don't come here. Stay in bed.
When you think it would be insignificant that somebody would stay in that bed,
bring money. It's our dilemma, isn't it? It's our dilemma. You know, we know that there's something wrong. There's a thing that I remember one day we were walking out of the tent, and I was up at the front of the tent, up at the tail of the tiger, and we were walking out, and somebody asked Trungpa Rinpoche a question, and I forget what it was, but his response was, things really are as bad as they seem. Really are. And I mean, I go even further and I say, things are not as bad as they seem, they're worse. They're worse. The problem isn't as bad as it appears, it's worse. We don't get that. We want it to be better. Things really are not the way they appear, you poor deluded wretch. Well, hell, they are that bad. They are as bad as they appear. As a matter of fact, our delusion is in the opposite direction. They're worse. So that's why we're here. We're here to figure it out, to awaken. The Bodhisattva, the question of the Bodhisattva. What is the Bodhisattva? Is it Mr. Rogers enlightened? Is it Trungpa Rinpoche intoxicated? Is it neither? Is it both? The only thing we can do is we can say the Bodhisattva is he who is brave enough to walk on the path of the awakened state of mind. Brave enough. So we come and we sit. We go to session. We bat our head against the wall. We do, we do, we do. We walk. We are willing to take action to deal with it. Far better not to begin. But once begun, best be done with it. Far better not to begin. Not to question any of life at all. I mean, go out there and make those bucks. Don't question any of it. Everything is just fine. You know, people, a lot of the political activities that I'm involved with, I mean, a lot of the demonstrations and things, I hear them reported in places, and I remember about a month or so ago, some report about a demonstration that I've been at, and it talked about dissidents. And look, the word, for the first time, the word struck me, you know, dissident. And I thought, yeah, I guess I am. I'm a dissident. You know, never kind of considered myself that particularly. You know, dissident. Dissatisfied. I'm not satisfied with things the way they are. I'm a dissident. My problem. You know, I'm not satisfied with the prison system. You know, it would be far better were I satisfied with it. I could just go in and teach meditation and everything would be just fine. But I've seen enough of it and recognized enough of it to realize that I find this a problem. I got a problem with it. I'm dissatisfied. There are those who can go in and teach meditation in the prisons and say, well, everything's fine. The prisons are the prisons, and I'm just there to teach meditation, but everything's okay. Well, that's one perspective. I go into the prisons and, you know, when I first went in, yeah, the prison's the prison and that's it and everything's okay and, you know, I'm there to teach meditation. 8 years later, I come to the point where I realize, wait a minute, something's very, very wrong here. The whole thing is very, very wrong. I'm dissatisfied with this. I am a dissident. My choice. And I have to live with that. Better not to be a dissident, certainly less problematic. Better to remain ignorant. Ignorance is really bliss, truly. If we were ignorant, we wouldn't have to be getting up at 7:30 on Sunday morning, dragging our ass down here, sitting on these cushions, you know, maintaining these postures and doing all of this stuff. We could be going up to the, you know, to the church and listening to nice organ music and sitting in pews and flowers and, you know, eyeballing the chicks.
That makes me mad. It really does. You hit a real sore spot there. I mean, listening to these preachers, God has a plan for you. What plan? How do I know I like this plan? I mean, like this, this person sits on a throne and he has nothing better to do than micromanage everybody's lives throughout the entire universe.
Right.
And if you have faith and hope, come on, give me a break. Oh, it's a sore spot for me. The crap that they feed you. Oh.
Well, no, I'm not disagreeing. I don't disagree. But you're a dissident.
I'm a dissident, yes. I am dissatisfied with that.
I hereby christen thee dissident. Christendom.
But you know what? It seems like what you're saying, dissident, you can remain ignorant, or you can be dissatisfied with something. Just the point of becoming dissatisfied with something is, to me, a light, a spark of awareness.
Ah, very good. Very good. What we see and what has somehow developed as the Buddhist tradition and the Christian tradition through the social fabric of the West have intersected, we find there's a notion in there that we somehow need to suppress or avoid negativity. Okay? At all costs. And this is the idea of the Mr. Rogers Bodhisattva. This is the idea of purity. This is the idea that somehow our problem is ourselves rather than our social order. The problem, all of the problems that we have are based on our psychology. There's something wrong with us. Right? There's something wrong with me because I'm a dissident. There's something wrong with me because I stand up and say, you people are running this prison and you're beating people to death and torturing them and creating an environment that's unhealthy. Well, there's something wrong with you. You're a dissident. Not a dissident. I just see it clearly. Right? You want Mr. Rogers or you want the truth? You want purity or do you want the truth? Do we have some concept that we have to follow a specific pattern of behavior in order to be something that we're not? Well, we have to be this, we have to be that. You know, I mean, a supposed Zen teacher a couple of years ago told me, well, we have to be inclusive. And I'm like, wait, what the fuck is this shit? We have to be inclusive. We don't have to be fucking anything. I don't have to be anything. I can be exclusive if I want. Thank you very much. We have to be this and we have to be that. Who says? Who says? Whose idea is this anyway? I'm going to become Thich Nhat Hanh? Give me a break. I grew up in the Bronx. You know, I'm not some little oriental man who's going to go around, you know, bowing and you know, maintaining, you know, some kind of... That, for me, I would be faking it if I did that shit. And I wouldn't be very good at it. I'd be downright clumsy. Better to be who I am. For all of us, better to be who we are. Better to be who we are. I'm me. You know, I got the shit kicked out of me on the streets of the Bronx. I was in prison. I got beaten and raped there. You know, I've done all this shit throughout my life. I can't deny all of that and pretend that you know, I'm something other than who I am. I go, why should I do that? Love and light, peace and joy, harmony. Well, hell, you know, hatred and darkness. You know, disharmony. What's the difference? It's all the same. It's all stuff. Ideas, concepts. Pigeonholing. You know, we're going to pigeonhole the bodhisattva into a set of rules and regulations? That's not the way the bodhisattva works. The bodhisattva does what needs to be done. It's not some kind of self-checking process.
Bodhisattva checklist, number one, number two, number three. I mean, that's absurd.
That's the watcher principle. And we run into this a lot. And I've talked about this before when people have asked about mindfulness practice. I went to a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat once, and it was done at a place where there were a lot of paths. The buildings were separated, and there were, you know, nice kind of paths going from, you know, building to building and place to place. So the whole campus was kind of, you know, had these paths. And, you know, I mean, I had things that I was doing, and there were various, you know, lectures and things that were taking place during this thing. And, you know, people would go from one place to another, and they had it set up so there were two lunch periods that in order to handle the volume of people. So, you know, there were constantly people moving along these paths, going from place to place, you know. And, geez, I remember one day I got stuck behind a bunch of people who were mindfully walking. I felt like kicking them in the ass. You ever see mindful walking? I mean, you know, it's an affectation. It's affected. You know, I mean, what are we doing mindfully? It's moronic. Simply walk. Just walk. And get the fuck out of my way. You know, it's lunchtime. I want my lunch. I don't want to be walking behind you people. You know, I mean, yeah, one foot in front of the other. Okay, great. Do it to the right. Let me get by.
Isn't the concept of mindfulness not taken to that extreme as far as focusing and concentrating on what you're doing, not being an asshole about it, but to try to eliminate all the crappy thoughts that you just go through life like asleep because you're constantly thinking?
Now, look what goes on in here, right, in this dojo, right? Initially, when the teacher comes in, right, and is working with people, right, he's teaching them something, moves, right, ways of the responding to moves. And initially they're done mindfully, or what we would call mindfully, right? In other words, it's part of training. For example, the example I use a lot is painting. Right? Anybody that's done any kind of, you know, house painting. I don't mean art painting, but house painting. You, when you're doing trim, right, you've got a, you know, you're generally using a semi-gloss paint, right, and you've got an angled paintbrush, and you know, you're doing the trim. Well, you can do it mindfully at first, what we would call mindfully, and that is bringing, you know, intense concentration onto making sure that you're stripping it in just perfect, right? But a professional painter is not painting mindfully. If anything, they're painting mindlessly. They simply strip it in. Big deal. You get so good at something that you no longer have to, it's no longer an affected action. It's your action.
But
it's who you are. It's the it's beyond developing a skill. It's inherent. You watch a professional painter. He's not paying attention to every nuance of the brush. He's just painting.
This is a tough concept. You know, like when you're driving in your car and your head's all full of shit, thinking about all kinds of stuff. You're thinking so much, you totally went past your exit.
Right.
Now, if you were concentrating on your driving, concentrating on where you were going, you would not miss your exit. And that's the point I'm trying to understand. Not that you go...
Right. Yeah, sure. Shit happens.
And it does.
You know, you miss your exit.
Don't you feel if your head is constantly clogged with all the bullshit that you think, it's almost like you do things and you don't even know what to do. You like to sleep.
Right.
That's the point.
Yeah.
But you're not paying attention like to the moment. You don't
right.
have to do it to the 1,000th degree.
Right.
But be mindful or understand, I am doing this, I'm not screwing that girl that I had couple of nights ago, which is not a bad thought.
Yeah, you know, actually. We do the best we can.
It's a valuable starting point in practice, I think. At least to become aware of your lack of mindfulness. I think the practice of becoming aware of that leads then to further abilities. Because back to the car analogy, when I learned to drive a car, I was very focused on clutch, brake,
right,
shift,
right,
assist,
right,
very focused.
Right,
now,
right.
I can drive a car, and I can be
right.
doing 1,000
well,
things in my
when,
head. Is there value? Am I driving a car?
When he went beyond this exit, he didn't crash into things. He still knew, he instinctively, you know, without even thinking, you know, did the brake and the accelerator properly and steered properly. I mean, it's that kind of level of practice.
But I missed the goal. The goal was to get off at that friggin' exit. That was the goal. I missed it because my mind was thinking about crap.
Well, it may have been thinking about crap, but on another level, it was driving very well. You didn't hit any trees. You didn't run into an abutment. You didn't get a traffic ticket. You didn't hit pedestrians. You're driving perfectly.
But the awareness of the machinations of the mind, the Tibetans study it to the quadrillionth degree of mind machinations, of how it works, by observation. And yeah, I know you brought up that it's really the mind watching the mind, but at least it's a jumping off point to become aware of, you know, these permutations.
That's why we bat our heads against the wall.
That's why ignorance is bliss. It's better not to begin. I keep saying that. But, you know, we're here. We're fucked.
Have you heard of this statement, what controls your thoughts controls you?
I hadn't heard that statement particularly.
But if you think about it, what you obsess over or whatever, really controls you.
Well, getting back to our point of anatta, there is no you to be controlled.
Yeah, we could spin it around and dance, but
you know, it's emptiness. It just washes through. I mean, that's the point of the sitting practice that we're doing. You know, we start out by doing the, you know, we get people, somebody walks in, you know, off the street, and, you know, you sit them down, you know, here's the posture, here's what you do. You begin by counting the breath, right? And they count their breath, and then they come in and they do an interview, and you're like, well, how are you doing? And they're like, well, I don't know, I keep getting distracted, you know? There's nothing wrong with that. That's perfect. That's exactly what's supposed to happen. But I'm being distracted and I can't get to 10. Right. Good. You've learned something. You've learned the nature of the functioning of the mind. And it ain't pretty. And that's absolutely. Absolutely. That's the lesson. This is the value. Oh, but I can't tell you how you value. I can't get beyond 3. I keep thinking about this girl I had a couple of nights ago. Well, hey, great. Wonderful. This is how it works. Oh, but there's something wrong with this. What are you teaching us here? You know, aren't we supposed to be getting free of all of this? No, we're not.